This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy. This is iFanboy Pick of the Week 918, brought to you by iFanboy listeners just like you.
If I didn't care more than words can say, if I didn't care.
My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and this is my co-host, Josh Flanagan.
Hey there.
And this is iFanboy Pick of the Week, episode 918. Welcome back, everybody. We made another through another week. You survived. Congratulations.
Barely.
So how do we reward ourselves for surviving? Well, we read our stack of comics. One of us picks their favorite. We call that the Pick of the Week. We talk about that from that book, other books from the week, the patron pick, listener mail. We have fun. It's therapeutic. It's entertaining, if only for us. And if that's all we can do, that's all we can do. In the meantime, here's a spoiler warning. I should set some caution this week. Yosh had a pick. But
the original Hebrew pronunciation.
I've been spending a lot of time around the Dutch. And so,
Yosh. Really, are you going to say something remarkably free of humor and slightly uncomfortable?
Listen, I've got several Dutch colleagues who are nice, but it was an adjustment period. And
I have a friend. I'm going. So whatever. I have a friend, and she went on a business trip to Finland, right? And she gets there, and she's in the car, and she's looking around, and she's going, "Oh, it's really beautiful here. I didn't know." And the cab driver goes, "Here in Finland, we don't feel the need to talk to fill space."
Yes, that they're very yes. And I was like, oh, they don't do small talk. Yeah,
and it wasn't rude. It was just as it was, but I was like, ugh.
Yeah, the Finns are like that. Yeah, it's all a cultural minefield over there.
I love it. It's great. It's so good. They speak perfect English, though. Everyone.
Yep.
I got the pick of the week.
You do.
All right. Pick of the week goes to me. Surprisingly to me, the pick of the week is The Man Bat.
Nope.
First Night, Book One.
Nope. No, it's not.
Wow. Why did I do that?
I don't know.
That's why it was a surprise. The Batman. By the way, it's written correctly. I just apparently developed immediate dyslexia. Yeah. The Batman First Night Book One, a black label. Black label.
It was interesting. They announced the return of Elseworlds. They're coming back. But all Black World. What's happening? All black label books are essentially Elseworlds books. So I don't know what's happening to this label. If it's staying as sort of more of an adult, Elseworlds thing, yeah. But it's essentially just another Elseworlds book. But I found that interesting.
Black label is Elseworlds if there's some swearing.
Yes.
Like it's like in the normal book where instead we write the little symbols, here right. We actually say fuck.
And no bat dongs.
No, that's over.
We learned that lesson.
It's funny is I don't remember what that book is. I just remember that it was genre shattering.
You couldn't even tell me. I couldn't tell you the name of it. If you put a gun to my head and the head of every loved one I have, I couldn't tell you the name of it.
Azzarello?
It was Azzarello.
Okay.
But That's all I remember. That's how much it was not a big deal.
So, the Batman with the hyphen between Bat and Man, in the Spider-Man fashion. I said, okay, this is just another retelling of Batman. I've had a lot of that, but I see Dan Jurgens, and I went, yeah, maybe that could be interesting. And I see Mike Perkins. And we haven't gotten to say that in a long time. And I thought, I haven't thought about that dude in a while. And I kind of looked at it and was like, all right, I'll read it. I had not a lot of books, but not a small amount. And, you know, first thing you see is this sort of, I want to say there's a double page spread of about 9 mocked up newspapers about telling us basically we're in the Depression here. And then you cut to
1939,
the
year Batman debuted.
That's correct. So it's contemporary. Origin. And again, all this sort of iconography in it is like Art Deco kind of the time. And then you get this really beautiful shot of Gotham City from a distance that just perfectly encapsulates where we are and what's going on here. I mean, like visually, I thought, wow, it's a beautiful shot of this sort of smoggy, cloudy, hot, there's this sort of I don't know, it just, I thought, wow, that's a great opening page. And I went, right, Mike Perkins is a pretty great artist. And we're sort of put into this world where it's Gotham, it's getting worse all the time, and there's a grisly murder at the beginning, and you know, Jim Gordon has to deal with it.
Well, hold on, it should be noted that the murder takes place at Nick and Joe's Italian Spaghetti House, and I definitely want to eat there.
Yeah, you do. Well, other than the chance of murders.
Right. I like to keep my head.
But just right away, like that sort of page outside of Nick and Joe's Italian Spaghetti House, which is both outside and inside very, very reminiscent of the where Michael shot McCluskey and the who's the crime boss?
He was the drug dealer, not the crime boss.
No. Not Tatalia, not Barzini. No, it was Barzini all along.
Barzini and Tatalia ordered the hit.
Right. Okay. Well, either way, it's that place. I mean, just think that's what it is. But the lighting on that first sort of splash page, where the whole thing is just colored beautifully by Mike Spicer. And I just, as I look through it, it really it sets the tone really well. And sort of the flashes on the cop and, no, the camera flash, not the superhero. You know, just tells us where we're supposed to be looking, and then you'll know who this is, who this actress is, or who the person is portrayed upon, I'm sure. But there's, you know, like a period woman who was in the restaurant. She's like, you're asking the wrong people, and I was like, oh, and it's just a little cartoony,
right?
But when I sort of adjusted myself to being in the mood and the genre that they were trying to do, I started having a lot of fun with it. You know, you cut outside and you see Bruce Wayne, you know, in his little roadster, and in this version, he has a close relationship with Gordon, who looks older than the Gordon that we would know at this point.
Yeah, definitely
in time.
Older.
And you know, like everything is drawn. They look like 30s and 40s stars. Like their faces. They don't look like modern.
Well, you know,
people.
They do keep, it's not always the case, but they do keep, which has sort of become a DC tradition now, that Bruce Wayne looks kind of like Gregory Peck, which started with Batman Year One. Mazzucchelli used Gregory Peck as the model, and then Alex Ross did old Gregory Peck as the model for Kingdom Come.
Is this him?
Perkins doesn't get it every time, but certain pages, like page 13, like that's definitely a young Gregory Peck. Mm-hmm. Like he's definitely going for that as the model.
So in this version, you know, since the murder, which all happened as normal, you know, Gordon has kept an eye on Bruce Wayne, and they have kind of a little relationship. And I mean, I think just in terms of what got me with this was sort of the look and feel and the tone. And I thought it all meshed really nicely. I really liked when Batman showed up. And he, you know, he looked, in many other contexts, this costume would have looked ridiculous, but
it
really
worked
here.
Well, it's the original costume. It's the original.
Yes, I know that, but it, like, because of that, like, I don't know, they just kind of made all those things work together, and they nailed that tone of what this was without being too throwbacky and silly, but without trying to be modern at the same time. And, you know, it was one of those things where just, where you go, man, Dan Juergens is still a master of this craft.
Yes.
And you know, I was just enthralled with the whole thing the whole time. I thought, again, the colors as I go through it, like it's just, it looks like it's supposed to. It's doing all the things that it should. Alfred shows up. I'm trying to remember like what it was, but I was incredibly surprised through the whole thing. I thought, wow, I'm actually reading a new old Batman origin. Mm-hmm. and really enjoying it, you know, despite the fact that shouldn't happen anymore, because you've seen it so many times over and over.
But I mean, it's not so much an origin. He's already there. It's just it's early days of his career, right, for sure.
I sort of refer to anything in the year one to two era where Batman is learning how to Batman. It tends to be like an origin to me, where, you know, that sort of first bit where, you know, he's like, oh, I'm not quite sure what I'm doing. And, you know, has to learn his way through and gets beat up a lot. Yeah, I assume you liked this.
I loved it. But I also love which is not new. They've done it many times. The idea of setting the character in the time period in which they originally appeared in comics. I mean, it's really no different than just going back and reading those original comics, because that's the time period. But, you know, they're doing a Batman story, him first appearing in the year he appeared in the comics, or, you know, it's not new, but it's always a fun, I won't say gimmick, but it's a fun device, because you get to play with the character as with the limitations that they were given back then, right? So he doesn't have a ton of gadgets or technology, because he didn't have back then. He's got like a roadster, and he's got some, you know, like pills in his belt that he like can make
bandages
and stuff. But like, he's not really, you know, he's just a guy in a suit with crazy ears. Mm-hmm. And I liked how weird the costume, like they made some kind of exaggerated version of his original costume. The ears almost look like Man Bat.
That's what I'm getting at. Like it looked real. It I don't know. It was like a way of taking what they did in the movie that, you know, whatever, or the news, not newsreel, serial movies that they would have done back then.
Right.
You know, and made it look like that. You're like, oh, it looks weird. But in this context, in this style, I was like, all right, I get it. I'm going with it. And maybe when a younger me would have been like, you look stupid. But now, you know, I can take in all of the different reasons that things are happening and appreciate it.
I was going to say, there's no Alfred. He's gone for some reason. Because in the original, originally wasn't there.
I thought.
There's a guy that looks like Alfred. It's Sir Martin Brock.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I was looking. It's, Sir Martin Brock.
And that's Julie Madison, who was Bruce's first comic book girlfriend. So I assume that's what we're going there. But.
You must have appreciated this way more than me, because I didn't really know the references.
Yeah, I was like, oh, Julie Madison. So, yeah, he tells Gordon that he hasn't seen the butler since college. So I assume it's because they didn't introduce Alfred till later in the book. So this is sort of, you know, in that, you know, early, early zone. But I even, you know, take Batman out of this. Mm-hmm. I love this. You know, like you said, the way it looked like a grimy Art Deco-y 30s story. The people looked like they were from the 30s. Mm-hmm. I don't think I picked up on the color at the time, but you said it. I'm looking through it, and the color is really terrific. You've got a dirty, grimy city, but there's lots of pops of color.
It's oversaturated in places,
and neon lights and things like you would have had back then. Like it's a really beautiful book. And Mike Perkins is great, but he can occasionally be cast incorrectly.
Yes.
You know, like wasn't he on a Superman? Didn't he do a couple issues of Superman that didn't really work, because he just doesn't, he's not the right artist for Superman, but he's the right artist for this.
Yeah. And I have a hard time.
It's weird. His character's a little weird looking and a little weird shaped, and the body language is a little weird, but it works in this story for sure.
And the only other thing that I can really be sure of his working on was he was sort of the backup guy on Brubaker and Michael Lark, Captain America. Is it Michael Lark? Yeah, and so he would do the issues, the flashback issues, or just every couple of issues, you know, every at the end of an arc or whatever, to sort of give Lark a rest. And like, he was great there. And I can see, you know, that book works with this kind of throwbacky kind of look. Real nice. I really, really liked the scene with the rabbi. And don't tell me that the rabbi was in it originally. I can't believe that.
I don't think he was.
Okay. You know, just a man who looks like he could use someone to talk to, you know. I love the caring rabbi, and he's like, hey, let me help you, don't worry about it. Like it's one of my favorite stereotypical characters.
Yeah, I mean, they've been sort of canonically making Bruce Jewish his mother is Jewish in the current continuity.
I saw that somewhere recently.
Which is why Kate is Jewish. The Kanes are Jewish. His mother's right. A Kane. It doesn't make any sense for the 30s. So I don't know if they're doing it here, because in the 30s, a rich blue blood WASP family would never have married a Jewish woman. But you could do it in the modern day, because it doesn't make a difference now. But
you can look at it retroactively and be like, wow, they really were progressive that they did this thing in Shoreditch. It doesn't right. matter. I got it. That's kind of the thing where like I kind of don't mind. It's like, well, all the men who created this maybe right. could have some representation retroactively. I'm cool with that.
Yeah, no, I have no problem with it. It's interesting to see if that's what they're doing here or not. It doesn't really make a difference. I just thought this was terrific. I think, you know, what you said is absolutely true. Dan Jurgens remains, you know, a master of this. The last stuff we really read of his was that Superman stuff, which was also really good. He falls into mm-hmm. that camp of Peter David, you know, people who still got it. They still should be working. And this felt, and as a result, felt very timeless in that this, yeah. I could have read this book 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like he could have written this and DC could have published this 25 years ago under Elseworlds. Like this book feels like DC books used to feel in the big sort of, not event, because that's a loaded word in comics, but a bigger release. Like, you know, in the 90s or 2000s, this would have been a big deal because Dan Jurgens was a huge deal. So like this would have felt like a big thing he was doing.
I feel like...
And it was terrific. I loved it. I really did.
I feel like writers who came up in the 70s and 80s, you know, like I don't know, Dan Jurgens, you know, I know that he was around in the 80s. He peaked sort of in the... They, like people who had worked pre-1986 don't to this day feel the need to try to impress with the work. They try to keep it exciting. Mm-hmm. They try to keep it moving. They're not trying to prove to you that they're real writers. If right. that, you know what I'm saying? Like that little bit like, oh man, I can show them to my take. I was like, no, we're going to make an exciting Batman story. It happens to be set in this time. But there's no, they're doing the Grant Morrison thing. Just make it fun, have it move. And Grant Morrison is a different example, but I think of him when I think of this. It's like, keep it moving, keep it fun. Don't worry about why the Batmobile's gone flat. And then just a fantastic old-timey cliffhanger on the last page.
Yeah, I was going to say that. It's a pretty crazy cliffhanger. When I got to it, I was like, oh, shit. So, yeah. and it's because in a book like this, anything could happen, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to spoil the cliffhanger, only to say it's a comic book. So Batman's life is in severe jeopardy. And so I was like, well, they could kill him off. I don't think they're going to, but they could, because in the Elseworlds story, anything's possible. So yeah. it makes for a legitimate right. going, you go, whoa, well, what's happening here? I mean, that wouldn't make any sense. But anyway.
Look at the coloring on that page. He's kind of all purple.
And I like how his trunks, because back then they just sort of like... They're underwear trunks. They're more like strongman circus trunks. Like they're kind of baggy, like
boxers almost.
They're almost like he's wearing loose boxers.
I did think as you look through his these are the old gloves, you know, that are sort of short and loose around the edge. Yeah. I thought that is a work hazard. That extra fabric around the wrist is a big problem. I can tell you that right now. You shouldn't do that. You want to tuck those into the sleeve.
Also, what's the ethical situation here where Batman busts up a electrocution? And they just said, well, we'll just throw him in the chair. I guess I just spoiled the cliffhanger, but still. Like, I was like, can they just do that? Just throw whoever breaks up the execution into the chair? Well, we got to execute somebody. I mean, I guess it's going to be you.
You think it was, they had to hook up all those leads and everything. Right. They had to make sure the breakers were set.
They didn't even bother with the sponge on the head. Maybe the electricity can't conduct. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, I thought this was terrific. I kind of knew this was coming. I'd seen something about it, but I didn't know what I was getting into when I first started reading it, and I was really thrilled by it.
Oh, man, look at some of the alternate covers.
Yeah, I love the blue one with the yellow. Yep. First Night is highlighted. Like that's a great. That looks like a pulp novel.
It was just a fun, well done comic book, and you know, Batman's. Still got juice, sometimes too much at the end of a book.
Well, when done properly, right? Like, like the mess of the current books cannot be understated. But this was like a classic Batman story, and I'm so much happier reading this than whatever, you know. There was so many bad words I was about to come out of my mouth. I stopped myself from saying all of them. Just whatever mess that is going on in the regular books. Let's talk about X-Men 32.
Yeah.
X-Men 32. I think they announced that. I can't remember what number they said it was, but is it 35? 35 is going to wrap up the whole Hickman Krakoa situation.
Jerry Duggan? Wait, I guess it's Hickman?
Well, the Hickman era, the Krakoa started. Right. Everyone calls it the Hickman era, even though he only wrote part of it.
Yeah.
But I think 35 is technically Uncanny X-Men 700. So that's what they're doing. They're doing the whole bullshit comic thing.
You know, it's funny because we've got, like, we're at the point now, and I did feel like I missed an issue here because I was like, I've been reading the ones, but I feel like I missed something, like some turning of the tide. But whatever, right. I could follow it. The thing I'm noticing is that we have switched gears, and now Orcus is on the run, basically. Whereas before, because I felt like we were gearing up and everything was going that way.
I kind of agree with you.
Polaris ripped up the satellite. And then I think this is the next thing that happens after that. But I feel like there was stuff in the middle that should have been there. But also, I got it. Like, I followed it. It wasn't a problem. It's just because it's comic books. I thought, did I miss something? Because
there's so many books we're not reading. So right. There's always the thing in the back of your head. So yeah, 35 is X-Men 35 mm-hmm. is also Uncanny X-Men 700 and also the wrap up of the Krakoa.
That's not
era.
A lot of time.
So, no, three more months.
And I think was it Iron Man was last week, and I'd had this thing kind of the same feeling where it had just been like, whoa, we zip forward. Now, what's interesting is that it's been going on a long time, this storyline, it feels like, and it is time to move along to the next phase of it. But a little part of me didn't want to.
It's been really fun.
A little part of me liked that sort of underground fighting back, and you're waiting for, you know, the turning of the tide. And maybe that's what I'm talking about, is I feel I didn't quite get that. I feel like I got the chapter that led right into, you know, the cut before you get to the turning of the tide, and now we're like, we missed it.
Yeah, I wonder, was it Polaris fucking up that ship, like with MODOK in it? I guess. Didn't feel like it. It didn't feel like we got the emotional catharsis of it.
Thank you for validating me.
Yeah. Yes. I totally agree with you. I did really enjoy this issue, but this one and the last one, I feel like there's been a lingering feeling in my head that I'm missing something, but I think that's just because we're not reading everything. But I did really enjoy it. I think it's still been really fun, and Jerry Duggan still can bring great moments. And I thought Magic was really interesting here, and I like angry, pissed off Polaris, who's now like her dad. She's still Magneto's kid. Does Magneto have kids anymore? I mean, I guess she's still his kid.
They're certainly indicating that she is.
Right.
I mean, they said she's the new master of magnetism. She uses a couple. She's a baller in this. And the one thing that Jerry Duggan does really well and is not afraid of is just giving everybody their overblown hero moments. It's very Warren Ellis sort of the way that these characters deal with things. There's a bravado that didn't used to exist in superhero comics for the most part, unless the character was like Hawkeye or Booster Gold or something like that, and it was like, they didn't know, but now there's a badassery that is accepted in the post Grant, not Grant Morris, well, him too, but
Warren Ellis. Yeah, the post. Warren Ellis the era. Post.
Does it feel like that started with him?
Well, I mean, in possibly, but yeah, it was basically
mainstreamized.
Like all of Warren Ellis's characters sauntered towards the camera,
yes,
right, and that became the thing. Not for every character, but for a lot of
them. But Jerry Duggan is very good at that. Is my point. And I think you had it here with both Polaris and with Magic, and the whole sequence of her like having the nanobots in her and she's tired and you know the who's not AIM but the Orcus guy who tried to sort of one up her, you know, he gets overwhelmed by her, and then the scene of like, I can fix you, but this is going to hurt. Maybe you should do it now. You know, and she says she's tough. And then, of course, she rises and she's like, let's ready to kill things. It moved very quick. It was very fun. I don't have a lot of history with any of these characters, but I either know them well enough or they're being written well enough that I'm able to appreciate them. So when Kate is reunited with Lockheed, you know, I felt that. I was like, oh, that's great, because she's been so dark and evil and brooding, and it's like that symbolizes this little bit of, you know, her getting her soul back.
Right.
After this war, as this war concludes.
There was a little cinematic moment here, page 14 on your digital reader, where She magic runs through a room with her sword and kills the guys in the room, but we see it from through the window. So we see it as their blood is splattering on the window. So we don't really see them get killed. We just see the aftermath of it. I thought that was a really nice storytelling device. I think this was, this remains good. I'm very curious to see what we do next, what the status quo is, you know, what they decide to do with the X-Men. It'll be interesting. But I really have enjoyed this. At least I've always been reading at least one X-Men book since the Krakoa era started, so I'm really enjoying this entire thing.
There is there's one bit. I have two notes, and then we will have to move along. There's one bit in here where they do a cool superhero thing, where Kitty makes the top of the hydrant. She phases it, and then magic makes a little teleport into.
Oh yeah.
And so the water goes, and I had to like go back and look and see what happened. I was like, oh, that's awesome. Because it all wasn't explained at all either. It was just they did it visually and it worked really well. And my final thought is, and I don't like to say this, I really like Phil Noto. Uh-huh. I always have. I like his style. He's been sort of back and forth on sequential stuff. It doesn't always work.
Right.
But usually I like the art enough so it doesn't bother me. As we get further away from the way that he used to draw, which was more photorealistic, whereas this is very flat and cartoony colored and clearly digitally drawn. And he always did digitally drawn, but I felt like there was much more texture to it and heft in the past. I don't love this. It's not bad. I have no complaints about it.
Right.
But like just aesthetically.
It's not my favorite.
It isn't. And I miss that artist who was super interesting. And I can see him in here, but I don't know that I would necessarily, at first I went, who is this? This is weird. Because it's really stiff. I think the first page has like a really stiff kick from a character. And I was like, that's weird looking.
Well, that was always the thing was he did these really terrific pinups and he was like the master of the cover or the single image.
But he got better.
He did get better. I don't know. I agree with you. This isn't the best Phil Noto I've ever seen.
I think it's the way that it's produced. In order to make it work, it needs more of him in it. Otherwise, it's funny because it's a different thing than in the past where you would look at the sequential stuff and be like, this is too stiff. It's not moving. I don't feel like that's the case here. I feel like the facial expressions and the poses for the most part are pretty good. I didn't love it. And I want to because I really do love his work. And I think that he's a genius, but may not be the best forte here.
I kind of wish Birds of Prey number 7 was the first issue of Birds of Prey. So in retrospect, I really enjoyed reading the first arc of Birds of Prey, Kelly Thompson, and who was the artist who was terrific?
I don't remember.
Leo.
But I also liked it.
Yeah. He did the cover. Is he credited here?
Leonardo Romero.
Terrific art. I really like scenes and I really like character moments, but I think looking back on it, I didn't love it as much as I thought at the time or perhaps hoped for. I never really got past, having Harley Quinn on the team. And I think looking at it also, I don't think I really followed or cared about the overall story that was happening in the book. Like I liked the characters being together, but I don't remember even what it was about other than I think it was rescuing Black Canary's sister?
Her sister.
I don't know who that person is.
Her name is Sin. I'd never heard of her. And she, I feel like it's like, we found out this was a sister recently for story purposes.
Right.
And she had a demon, basically. What's it? Not infect, but possess her.
Right.
Or it had like taken root inside of her and tried to take her over. And then, of course, the solution was they made a deal and they had to have a big fight on it. It was a lot of set pieces that I thought were set up pretty well.
I think the art was fun. It was, like I said, lots of good character stuff. I liked the whole part where they had to invade the mascara. I don't want to get too much in there. I'm just saying, looking back on it, I don't think it held together as a whole as much for me as I had hoped it would. This felt much more like a classic Birds of Prey story. Harley Quinn is gone. The team is at this point, because Birds of Prey team often changes. The team at this point is Black Canary and Cassandra Cain, Batgirl, and Big Barda, and Barbara Gordon is there as Oracle, and Sin is also there, who again I just never heard of before that arc, or don't remember hearing about her before that arc. But it just felt much more fun and classic. Vixen makes an appearance in civilian form, and then there's
who that is.
yeah, no, that's and there was some, and the Javier Piñart, very different than Lino Romero, much more of a classic superhero stuff. I thought it was terrific.
It was a great page where
Vixen's, you know, she's a clothing designer. She's trying to dress Cassandra. Was it Cassandra?
Yeah.
Or is that Sin? Either way.
Cassandra. It is.
It's all in facial, all of her reactions and facial expressions. And I thought that was terrific. It was very much sort of Kevin Maguire-esque. And I just thought it was really fun. And I'm happy about this team lineup. I'm happy the book's still going. I'm looking forward to what this arc has to bring.
I really liked the characters in the last arc and having them interact with each other. I thought that was actually a lot of fun. And I'll include Harley Quinn in that to a certain extent. Whatever, her character is whatever they need to be in a book now for marketing purposes, fine. But as I sort of flip through this and I see, you know, the picture of Barda and Batgirl, Cassie? Both. She's called both, right? Both, yeah. And I just thought, I can have, and they're like talking to each other. And I know that this Batgirl shouldn't talk, but I don't care. I like these characters together an awful lot.
Yeah, and those two are great together.
I liked that at the end of this, they just basically put him in swimsuits and underwear, and like it was just like, this is what you want, right? it was a way of sort of taking back the stereotype of sort of how comic books have always done women in that way, and I really enjoyed it.
I just like this. This is a great group. I agree with you. I think Barda and Cassie are terrific as a sort of Laurel and Hardy team, you know. And what is wrong with us today?
Barbara and Dinah, we have to use their real names.
Barbara and Dinah are, you know, they're like best friends, and they have a great relationship. And Vixen's great.
It was a good setup to end that last story the way it did with the threat against Barbara.
Right.
Into this, which is sort of what sort of leads into this. I really like that I don't know her name, but Vixen, that's her name.
Mari.
Yeah. So I don't think I ever knew that.
Yeah.
You know, she's a fashion designer. And as you look through the art and sort of the way that it's completed, there's even a misregistration to it, I think. They kind of look like fashion drawings.
Right.
They have that sort of softness to it and those lines and, I don't know. It lends itself. There is almost like a little of that, or like a little Mary Worth.
Well, they're doing something with it. Like Jordi Belair's on colors, and it's almost like the pages are faded a little bit. It's an interesting technique they're doing.
It's like a fake misregistration. If you look around on that last panel, if you look around the edges of like the outlines of their arms, there's like a green yellow color. And that's what would happen, you know, when the plates didn't line up correctly. And that would happen a lot in old comic books. And they're doing it here now on purpose
It looks good. It looks really good.
If you tell me this is Jordi Belair, I go, oh yeah, I can see it, but it doesn't look like what she normally does.
Right.
This is a whole other muscle flex here. Speaking of muscle flex. Anyway.
Very good though. So Captain America 757 or 7, this is I want to say start of a new arc, but kind of not really. The story is still going about him and these demons, but the whole flashback to the Bund is over. And
just me, or is the Bund around at a lot of things I've seen lately?
It's not good. I don't like that it's in the zeitgeist.
No.
So I enjoyed the previous arc from J. Michael Straczynski and the artist whose name escapes me. I think it was two different artists. Now we have Carlos Magno in the book, who's done a lot of Captain America stories. I think I mentioned it before, it's just a weird choice to have it be all about Cap versus demons. It's not really in the milieu of Cap. I don't really love it overall. So I was able to sort of look past that because in the previous arc, it was half of it was not about that. It was about the flashback to him fighting the Bund. So now we're fully in demon land. And it's very strange. And I thought that there was a couple of instances here where the characterization of Steve was even kind of odd. And I thought he had a pretty good handle on him in the last arc. But there's one point where he goes to this theater and it's all full of people who are special. And a girl recognizes him and asks him for his autograph. And he sighs at her. And I thought, would Steve ever sigh at someone who wanted his autograph? Like, I can't really picture that ever happening. You know what I mean? Like a sigh is a very specific reaction to someone. It sort of diminishes them.
Mm-hmm. And he wouldn't
it's
do
not,
that.
It's not like, hey, no, not, this is not the right time. It's, you know, and I can't ever mm-hmm. picture Steve doing that to somebody. Especially.
Well, I think that his sigh speaks for all of us in that we got JMS'd. I don't know if you guys have had this experience before, newer readers. This was terrible. This was abject. I went, what the f-? It took nothing that I liked about the last run, which was about 55% of the last run I liked. And I don't like Carlos Magno.
He's
done stuff. It's okay. But like, this wasn't great. Like, nobody has any necks.
They made Steve really beefy.
The color wasn't like, there's nothing about it that was bad. Just as a whole, it didn't work. I don't understand what going into this weird theater in Gotham is about. And I was like, wait, at first I was like, okay, this is supernatural. I was like, wait, is it? And I don't care. I was mad. I had JMS'd. I knew this was coming because I really do, because I know that I don't like his work for various reasons, even though I recognize a craft. But there's always a point where I'll go like, all right, I'm going to give it a shot. This is okay. I'm trying to get past my own bias. And then this comes up. I'm like, fuck, he did it again. I was really like, I put this in the sort of shorter sections. I should be like, this was fucking awful. And I know that I don't like to, you know, I don't just want to bag on something for no reason, but it was such a, just like they got rid of everything that was good about the last bit. And now it's this. And I don't know. I don't know.
Trying to find the other moment where I thought this was out of character, but I can't find it. But
there were several. I don't know if I can put one down, but there were several times I was like, who is this? And I thought it was just sort of the things he was saying. I don't know, even just him sitting in the theater felt weird. You know, like he's got his hands crossed. He's like, I don't know. He's not upright and forth. The look on his face.
He's kind of pouting, scowling.
He's scowling. And I was like, that's not. You know, you do that if you're captured by the Nazis. Other than that, like, he's got this under control. No, that's a big no.
He's sort of fighting for God against the devil. I don't know.
I don't even know. I can't even tell you.
I did enjoy the brief scene of him and Sam watching a superhero movie and being like, this is terrible. I did like that scene.
Yes. Yes.
Even though Sam was completely on a strange, very strange model. I liked that where they were like, this is, do they even talk to, like, this is terrible. We would never do that. Like, I thought that was fun.
What is on Sam's shirt? It says Avengers and then has a little stylized CA. So it's like he's wearing his merch.
Maybe he is wearing, he's modeling the merch.
It's awful.
What is he, wearing? Like, did, what is his,
did, like, did he's the got, artist like, design he's got, like, a logo? On? Did he design a logo on that shirt for Captain America? Because it's a bad logo.
God, what is that? That's a weird logo.
Yeah.
What's with the armbands?
Oh, that's a good question. Maybe he thought he was drawing Luke Cage. And then maybe that's what shirts, that's the look of Captain America merch in this world.
It was disappointing. It was disappointing. It was very disappointing.
It was bad. I knew it was going to be 50-50. Like, I was going to be like, this fucking sucked. And you'd be like, no, it was good. But I was like, I think we're all going to agree it sucked. I think if anything excited me this week, it was the title that said Aliens What If Number 1. We've already discussed.
I thought maybe it might be pick of the week when I saw the list.
I thought it was a lot of fun and I enjoyed it. It was not a pick of the week level thing.
Was Paul really Reiser?
Yes. So it's not exactly clear, but basically this story is what if Burke lived? Burke was Paul Reiser's character in Aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I don't know that that's a great premise because under no circumstances should that character live. And it appears to have been a story that was conceived. So, okay, it's written by Hans Rodionoff and Adam F. Goldberg.
Right.
Okay. But it says the concept is by a lot of names, Paul and Leon Reiser. I'm assuming that's his son. Adam F. Goldberg, Hans Rodionoff, and Brian Volk-Weiss. So whoever those people were like, I had an idea, and they all had it at the same time, apparently. Anyway, so that's the sort of top credit. And that's what the story is. In Aliens, Riser is a scumbag from the corporation, and he's there to get a sample of the xenomorph to bring it back to Earth for exploitation by Weyland Yutani. And he goes into a room, and he's killed by the alien. So this says, what if he's not killed by the alien? And it tells the story, you know, of him sort of getting away off planet, and then Yutani tries to sort of cut him loose, and he sort of makes a deal with them, and they screw him over, and he ends up on some crappy planet somewhere, and his life sucks. And it's to be continued. Like, it's not over, which, by the way, is not the way that these are supposed to go. What if should be one issue?
No, supposed to be one issue.
One issue. So this is a multi-part thing.
Tell a story.
It was fine. It got better as it went on because, to be honest, I don't know that Paul Reiser's character in that character was all that
deep or
needed.
Nobody wanted more of him.
No,
nobody
exactly.
Nobody asked for it. Nobody wanted more.
I very clearly remember seeing that movie for the first time and going, what is he doing in this? it it works. I have no problem with it now. But as a little kid, I was like, this isn't what's supposed to be happening. That guy's from the other TV show that's very different than this.
He's a good actor.
He is. Also, the art of old Paul Reiser, that was I was about to say the stupidest thing. I was like, boy, that's really, it looks great when he looked like old. And I was like, Josh, he is old now. And there's a great deal of visual material to show what he looks like. Is that? Because I imagine that the artist had to imagine what he might look like older. But then I realized that was 38 years ago.
You realize it's not 1986 or something anymore?
No, it's not. This is not a new film.
Blue Beetle number 7 was a tribute to Keith Giffen issue written by Josh Trujillo and art by Adrian Gutierrez, Natasha Bustos, Howard Porter, Cully Hamner, Scott Collins. It was just a sweet tribute. It wasn't like groundbreaking. Booster Gold and Jaime Blue Beetle have to team up because Ted Kord is missing in the time stream, you know, and so it requires them to travel to 3 different locations in time to set these beacons. It's all just comic book gobbledygook and just a way to visit the old time lines. The first one I go to is the Justice League International time. I don't know. I really wish it had been drawn by McGuire. I was going to say, I don't know why. There's all kinds of reasons why it couldn't be, or maybe it wasn't, but they got an artist who kind of looked like Ty Templeton. He was another artist who did alternate issues back then. But it was fine. And then they went to the future, to the Legion of Superheroes time, because Giffen did a Legion of Superheroes book, and Howard Porter drew that part. That part looked really good. And then, you know, they eventually get him back, and they go, you know, they're in the future, and there's a whole joke about Johnny DC, the continuity cop, has come to yell at Jaime because he's broken the time stream, and the next thing she's going to do is she's going to fix the Huntress. Like, it's just a very meta book, and then Ted Kord comes back, and it's just... I enjoyed reading it. I didn't love it. It was okay, but it was a nice little tribute to Keith Giffen, and I enjoyed it. I had no problem following the action and everything that's happening. And some of the art was really good.
Fun stuff. I'm curious why you wanted to talk about Doctor Strange number 439.
Because it was I thought it was a really fun conceit in which Jed McKay gets to take all the characters that he's been writing over the last few years and put them together in a story. So it's Doctor Strange has to bring together Black Cat and Moon Knight and Taskmaster because essentially Dungeons and Dragons comes to life in New York, and he has to form a team of a thief, a warrior, a priest, and a magician to go in because they have to play by the rules of the game. It was
a pretty neat little bow that he came up with there. I mean, first of all, that concept came up and I went, nobody's done this. And then also to be able to then say those characters, this is it's just a very classic Dungeons and Dragons conceit, but like having all the characters that he has written fit into those roles, I was like, did you think of that first?
Or did you just stumble on it?
That's pretty good. I'm gonna make
I did enjoy it. I was waiting for the moment where Clea was like, so how do you know her
white hair one? I was like, oh, you both have that. Same deal here, by the way. Pascal Ferry, I was like, it's too digital. It's taken away.
All these digital, they're making everybody's art thin.
Look, there are some people, you know, who can do it really well. There's other people who came up doing it. You know, your Mitch Garrett's or something like that. But a lot of these guys who used to work in a certain way, and I can't begrudge them at all. you know, especially if you've been doing comics for 30, 40 years or something like that, and that helps you do it or whatever. But, you know, it's not, it's not what it was. It's missing something because it just is. And I was always sort of on the fence about Pascal Ferry, and that, like, I get it and I respect it. It wasn't my favorite thing, but now with even a little more of it taken away, I was like, nah, it's.
I have another book that you left off the script called The Spectacular Spider-Man number 1.
I did.
I wanted to mention it's the first issue of this new book that features Peter and Miles teaming up, written by Greg Wiseman, who is a prolific TV cartoon writer. He was one of the people responsible for the Spectacular Spider-Man cartoon, which I think is the best modern Spider-Man cartoon, one of the best superhero cartoons. And he also did Young Justice, which was one of the best modern DC cartoons. So he's got a lot of superhero experience in that sense. Drawn by Humberto Ramos, who I don't know if he's doing it on digitally or on the board, but his stuff looks terrific still.
Yes, it does.
And I thought the issue was maybe 15% too quippy, but I really enjoyed it, and I thought it looked terrific, and I thought it was a fun little story.
I thought the same thing. I think I was like, I just want it toned down a little bit.
Just turn the dial a little bit.
I thought the bits were good. It was completely unnecessary. And if you were a ruthless editor, we'd have cut it out. But there's a page where Peter really wants to be a regular at the place. And there's like a page of many, many panels where he keeps trying to get the guy to remember his name and his order, you know, and it kind of doesn't work out. And it's funny. I keep thinking that the bad guy's going to be that big dude, but I don't know. They didn't reveal that.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it was fine.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was fun enough. I think the one thing you shouldn't do in this story is constantly point out how dumb it is they're both named Spider-Man and what a problem that is.
Yeah.
Because it is, and it is.
Well, but, I mean, that's a judgment call, I think, to that extent. But what I did like is that it didn't get heavy. And I just always feel like every time these characters are together, it ends up getting really heavy. And I hope that they avoid that.
Yeah, I like it as a counterpoint, right? It's like, if this is their fun side adventures. They get together once a week and they have these silly, you know, fun old timey superhero adventures. And I thought it was, I thought it was incredibly entertaining.
Yeah, it's good. It was fun.
Those are the books we wanted to talk about. But at patreon.com/ifanboy, we are off tonight, both of us. Patreon.com/ifanboy. Every patron of the show gets to vote to add a book to the rundown. This week, the patrons voted. And it was a trifecta. Ultimate X-Men number 1, all three Ultimate books were made patron pick. This one just barely eked it out over a couple other books. So it was a little dicey there for a second. But Ultimate X-Men number 1, written and drawn by Peach Momoko, with a script adaptation by Zach Davison and letters by Travis Lanham. And so this is the third and final, or at least for now, regular Ultimate series after Spider-Man and Black Panther. Spider-Man being... different enough, featuring a middle-aged Spider-Man. Black Panther feeling like it wasn't different enough. It felt just like a regular Black Panther book. This would be the biggest departure. And I don't know.
Go on.
I see a lot of craft here. I actually really liked it as a story on its own. Mm-hmm. And it features the X-Men character Armor, which I can't imagine anybody's favorite character.
Anything about? I know her, like I've seen, because I think probably because of Marvel Snap, but that's about it.
I'm trying to think of a comic less for me that wasn't bad, but not for me. And this might be number one of the bullet.
I have read worse comics for me this week. Multiple. I could name you several.
Oh yeah, no, this wasn't bad. It just was not for me.
No, I mean, I'm saying for me in that sense. And so this was the one that when I saw the cover for it, I thought, wow. That's an incredible departure for what is ostensibly a mainstream Marvel book. And we've seen all sorts of different variations on sort of Marvel stuff, but they're sort of off to the side. And while this isn't necessarily, you know, the 616 world, the Ultimate label and this sort of relaunch with the other names involved with it, it's kind of a big deal. And I thought, wow, this is bold, you know?
It's incredibly risky. Bold to go this far afield.
Yes.
I mean, this is not an X-Men comic, so at least right now.
Right. So I saw that cover and I thought, oh, that is not going to work. And I fully admit that. I thought that's not what the people here are looking for.
Well, also, it's important to understand. I saw lots of reaction to this book from people who are significantly younger than us who are very excited because they grew up watching anime.
And I will,
we did not.
I will, And I will take it the first. I did then after I thought that. I thought, you know what? A lot of people read books that look like this, and maybe it's a thing. And I was curious. So patron pick or not, I would have read this. I was sure. going to read it.
Yep.
And like, I think is what you said was is true is that right away, I thought, I forgot it was an X-Men book. And as I did that, I was actually able to enjoy it. I think right away, first thing, I thought, this is actually quite beautiful. Like the coloring is
beautiful,
really true. Lovely.
Yeah. Looks like an illustrated children's book.
And I was kind of, but even like it, once I started reading, I was like, it looks like a mainstream comic book to me done in this style. And I was interested in it. My biggest complaint is that it was difficult to read the font that was coming out of whatever this Wraith thing is. Mm-hmm. I was like, what the hell is that? I don't know what to make of it. I was curious how it was going to tie back into X-Men. I had either forgotten what I'd looked at in the cover or never noticed it, but when she almost gets hit by the car and does the armor thing, I was like, oh, it's that character. You know, I always do like a story that is set in another culture or being told by another culture. And one thing that I thought was really interesting as I was doing the credits up for this is that, you know, it says translated by, or what is it? It's mm-hmm. an adaptation by script adaptation. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting that this was originally written presumably in Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, that's really because, you know, I can't think of another mainstream Marvel book where the script was not written in English and then adapt. I mean, we get books like that all the time in America, you know, that were adapted, but not mm-hmm. in this sense. That was, I couldn't think of one. I'm sure there was. Mobius did a book once. Who knows?
It's definitely ballsy to take a property like X-Men into something that I'm going to assume most people are not expecting
most of the sort of regular readers, I think, are going to be.
And the real question is how many are going to hang on until it becomes something recognizably X-Men, because it's not right now. It's not at all.
And that's the whole thing that I am interested. Like, that's the thing that's interesting is like, what's going to happen with it? And so in that way, Brian Hill wrote the Black Panther one, right?
Yes.
I love Brian Hill. And that was so boring. And so in that way, this was more interesting than me. If you were like, which one do you want to read the next issue of? I would rather read the next issue of this than the next issue of Black Panther, given what we saw. And then, you know, over here, like if you're going to talk about doing a different take on the characters and changing it, well, this is one way to do it. Now, I'm not going to sit here and be like, oh man, I loved it. But I was, like we said, I was impressed by the balls. I really did. I was like, this is a really beautiful, well-made comic.
And the craft of it's really, really
like, it's gorgeous. I don't know if this is, I assume it's digital, but it looks like watercolor. You know, it's all very light. It just doesn't have nothing about it other than sort of the storytelling was pretty mainstream American comics, I think. The panel layouts and such. But just sort of everything else is so different than as an X-Men thing, you know, to be in this position in a sort of publishing lineup. It's kind of crazy.
It's interesting to think about, and I don't want to go on too long, so we're already over time, mm-hmm. but it's interesting to think about now that we've had the first three or the three books come out, what this launch feels like versus the original one 24 years ago. And I can't say that this one's nearly as exciting or interesting.
I mean, I think I think the purpose of it is different. I think the world that it exists in is different. I think, you know, that's a casting off the shackles of, you know, everything that came before them in a mainstream sense. Like Marvel had never done that unless you count some of the Jim Shooter stuff. And whereas this, since then, we've seen so much diversity. And I don't mean that in terms of people, but just cultural influences affecting what comic books look like. There's much less of a monoculture in comics now as there was back then. And granted, those books were more or less just regular mainstream books. I think the fact that these three books have almost nothing to do with each other, nothing in common.
Right.
It's very strange.
That's the other thing. It's a hard time seeing this one fitting into the world of the other two mm-hmm. books, but I had a hard time fitting Black Panther into the world of Spider-Man. So it's very interesting how they've done it.
Yeah.
So that's the patron pick. Let's do ratings on Ultimate X-Men number one ratings.
Wow,
that's lower than I thought. That's lower than I thought.
I mean, like, I'm intrigued more than I am impressed, because I really enjoyed a lot of it. but I couldn't tell you what the story is right now. I don't know.
Right.
I thought it was beautiful to look at, and I was, you know, and I'm very interested to see how it's going to resolve. That's my big thing, because from a creative perspective, from a publishing perspective, I'm really curious where they're going to go. I can't figure out the hook.
Yeah, I'm gonna give it 3 stars, and I'll read number 2 if, depending on the week it comes out, depending what else is going on. I'm more just curious to see if they plan on making this into an X-Men book done by Peach Momoko rather than just this character piece of armor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to see what Momoko would do with the X-Men, but I don't know if I'm willing to, you know, put in 13 issues to get there like they did with the original Spider-Man book. So I don't know.
I mean, the other thing to remember is that for the most part,
those
Ultimate books outside of Spider-Man, I guess the Ultimates did. The Ultimates and Spider-Man sort of caught on in a way, but both in completely different ways. You know,
they had two smash hit books out of the gate, and, right. And X-Men was always a mess.
X-Men was a mess the entire time.
Yeah, whereas this, and I guess maybe X-Men is cursed. Like, you just can't do it.
But remember Kirkman did it for a little while?
All of them did. Brian K. Vaughan, Mark Miller. Yeah. They threw every big name at that book, and nobody worked.
Murderer's Row.
Yeah.
Of people who couldn't make that book work.
Bendis.
Probably, yeah.
Everybody.
That's crazy.
Patreon.com/iFanboy. That's where you can go to add a book to the rundown. I'll do this part real quick. So patreon.com/iFanboy is the main source of support. We thank everyone who joins our community. You get all kinds of great perks. You get tier exclusive merch. You can sign up for yearly memberships or monthly. You get ad-free versions of the show. You get the Discord server, all kinds of fun stuff. Patreon.com/iFanboy. iFanboy.threadless.com is our merch store. We got 13 designs. iFanboy.com/support is our digital PayPal tip jar. iFanboy.com/Amazon is where you can do all your sort of general shopping. There's a shopping link there, but you can also, once we fix the page, you'll be able to find all the Booksplode books. And then bookshop.org is our partner that helps local bookstores out. When you see links for bookshop books on our page, those are orders that are fulfilled by local bookstores, and they get the money from the order. And thank you very much for all the people who support the show and all the various ways we do it. All of our mini shows helps keep the bills paid, the lights on. Thank you very much. And now, if you are a patron at the $5 or higher level, you get a superpower live on the show. Sometimes the person forgets they have to do it, and it happens live. But I suspect Josh did not forget because he had to write the script.
I did. And when writing the script, I took a moment and I breathed in. And what I figured out was that Jesse Johnston can at any time, you got to let me get through this. He can summon the Council of Civil War Generals. They do so by writing in an old timey journal with an old timey pen.
Okay.
And he can ask questions of the Civil War generals. Any of them, and this is going to be controversial to a certain extent, but there are instances in which maybe Stonewall Jackson has some useful advice for you. They're not going to be on social issues.
I have questions.
So he opens up the book, and he writes in the, he has to dip his pen in the ink pot, inkwell, and write it out. It's necessarily a quill. They had pens, but it very likely could be a quill. And he scratches it out. You can hear that, right? What should I do?
Scratch.
If he doesn't specify which general, then any of them could answer. You know, you could be talking about John Bell Hood.
He's writing his question in the book. He doesn't summon them via the book and they appear before him.
Nope. No, they answer him.
They answer through writing on the book.
Right, and they'll sign it.
I see. It's not like there's a semicircle of old Civil War generals sitting in a ghostly
George B. McClellan commanding
a ghostly circle around him to answer his questions. It's through the book.
Mm-hmm.
Is it only one specific book, or is it any kind of old journal?
No, it's a special one. It's
special
his.
Book, a special magic book.
I'm going to say that he can't fill it up either. It's everybody.
Is it a specific council or every general's available?
It's every general who fought in the Civil War.
Okay.
U.S. Civil War. And I'm counting Joshua Chamberlain because he ended up as a general later on.
Sure. Well, wait, was he a general during the war?
No, he was colonel.
Well, he can't be on there.
Well, I don't know when he was promoted. He was injured. Hang on. I'm gonna look it up.
About alcohol, is it always going to be Grant who answers?
All right. You know, he had good qualities.
I'm just saying, if he's looking for something to drink, is it always going to be? Is Grant going to muscle, you know, General J.E.B. Stewart out of the way?
Let's see. He reached the rank of brigadier general, but when? Like, here's the thing is that, and they're all going to be, they're not going to know anything about the world now.
No.
They're all of the time they live in. And so you really have to phrase.
Asking for advice about investing is not going to work because they're going to.
Unless there are hard and fast rules of investing, then I don't know. I'm guessing not. I don't think that's a good idea. But he, you know, it's part of it is that he's going to have to decide.
We wish you had this power.
I mean, I think it would be awfully interesting. He was, right, by the way, Joshua Chamberlain, promoted to Brigadier General, 1864.
Okay.
Just saying, it was during the war.
So then he's fine.
Yeah, he is. You could talk to him. He's definitely worth something.
Thank you for being a patron, Jesse Johnston. Enjoy your magic book of Civil War generals.
I believe that Jesse is very much going to enjoy or be quite vexed by that.
Let's do one email.
Okay.
And
you going to pick?
I kind of want to do the second one only because of what the comics this week, but you can tell me since it's your show what you want to do.
Let's do the second one from Malcolm. Malcolm says, stupid thing to be thinking about at 6:30 a.m. on a Saturday morning. Ileana's teleportation is her mutant power. Everything else is magic learned while in limbo. But she was kidnapped prior to her mutant power developing. Yet, her mutant power is connected to limbo, taking her through limbo prior to getting to the other location. Is this from psychological trauma that causes her to go through limbo? Or were her powers always going to be connected to limbo, and that's why Belasco chose her? There has never been an explanation as to why Belasco picked her, or why her power has taken her through the place of her worst trauma even prior to her becoming ruler. All you, Connor. Go for it. As that went on, I got further and further away from any form of understanding.
I don't understand anything he's saying. He could be making it all up. But I did follow it, and so I think I understand him, even if I can't answer him. Does that make sense?
Go on.
I'm also impressed that at 6:30 in the morning, he was having this debate in his head. I so love that and appreciate it and think that's
fortunately
awesome.
He put this into email form rather than borrowing Jesse's magic journal because they would have cursed you as a devil worshiper and found a way.
What Malcolm should have done is written this email however many years ago when Ron was on the show. I don't know. I think it's great though that you're thinking these questions because that's the fun of the comics, is right? Is there's all this wacky stuff that happens that can't ever make sense and don't always explain, and it allows you to in your head in between stories to wonder about this stuff. I think that's cool. Also, I don't know much about magic. She kind of came around.
She's
when I wasn't reading those books. I think she was first in the New Mutants book, and
she's. She's reading those comics. She's Colossus's sister, yes?
Right. But I just don't know anything about her really other than she shows up when they need to teleport somewhere. She's got a sword and an anger problem.
I honestly didn't even know I didn't know her power. I know she has a big sword because she was in the Strange Academy. She was one of the teachers there.
I think she's a great character.
I don't think I know enough about her.
I always like when she's around. She's like, oh, that's fun. Magic's here. Mm-hmm. But I think... She was part of that like wave of characters that came around in the 90s when I wasn't reading those particular comics. So
the last Claremont burst of extreme creativity that I can't assign quality to because I don't know how to judge it.
Like my buddy Patrick growing up, he read all those books. He would have been able to tell me all about her. But so she first appeared as herself prior to becoming a hero in 1975 in Giant Size X-Men number one. So that must have been when Peter first appeared. He must have been his sister. She must have just been on the farm with him.
Right.
And then as Magic in 1983 in the Magic, in a Magic miniseries, Magic Storm. And that's interesting.
See, I put her much later. I thought she was like Like Jim Lee era, or X-Factor.
Well, that's because later on, then she was added to the New Mutants comic in 84, and she was sort of in that vein of X-Men.
Still earlier than I thought.
Much earlier than I thought. But you know, then she was in the New Mutants Truth or Death in 1997. And then she was in like all these books I wasn't reading. I was reading Uncanny X-Men, and I was reading X-Men, and I was reading X-Factor. But I never really delved into the New Mutants side of the X-Men equation. So, like, I'm looking at these covers, like Cannonball, and like, I don't really know much about those characters other than their names, and you know, because I just never read those books. Mm-hmm. But interesting, she had her own miniseries. That's interesting. I do like her. Like, she's a big sword. She's got anger issues. She's got a demon thing. They like her. They use her a lot. Now.
She's very, very competent.
And she's a good plot device. So if they need to transport somewhere, they can do that.
She was just in. She was also in the Spider-Man stuff with Ben Reilly. And when,
oh, right,
those were her demons that got out.
So I love this email, even though I can't answer it, Malcolm. I really do love it. If you have, if anyone has like insane comic book ramblings from 6 o'clock in the morning that they have, things they just can't get out, send them in. This is awesome. I love seeing appearing inside everyone's brains.
And I got to say, I think an earlier version of us doing the show may not have said that. But now, like every time another weird word came up in this just full sense of nothing making sense or working together, and it becomes clear, and you go, it's great. It doesn't matter. Like the worst, especially a thin line, if something is cool, then the worse things don't make sense, the better. If something is terrible, then the worse that things don't make sense is a problem. And that's right. That's objective. I can't explain that to you. That's the art of the whole thing.
Contact@ifanboy.com is how Malcolm wrote in. Thanks for doing so. Let's quickly plug some stuff. This coming week, on the you'll see a new media explode this coming week. We're recording it on Monday. It'll be released on Thursday. I assume we're doing that whole thing with the TV shows. We haven't talked about it, but that's coming this week.
I can't promise because I don't like to make promises, but I have a booking. And if all goes well, there should be a Talksplode in the near future.
That's you got someone on the hook. You're reeling them in.
I'm uncomfortable saying that much.
Right. Someone has agreed to talk to you.
When you say it that way, basically,
someone has acknowledged your existence.
They almost always agree if they reply.
So that's coming
it's
soon.
The
hopefully,
non-replies
sure.
that really vex me.
Everyone, check your spam folders.
I would ask the generals about that.
Is it me or is it the spam filter? You can find our library of over 1,300 shows and counting over at ifanboy.com, wherever podcasts are sold. You can follow us at ifanboycomics on Instagram to find out what the pick of the week is before the show comes out, and sometimes for the best of the week in panels. Individually, we are C.S. Kilpatrick on Instagram and J.A. Flanagan on Instagram.
Subscribe to youtube.com/ifanboy, where you will find all of our old video shows and this audio show, which gets posted every week as well. So you may enjoy it in as many possible ways of conveyance as there are. We respect that. You can consider writing a review or leaving a star rating or giving a thumbs up or whatever it is. If you're there, if there's a way to express your goodwill, but whatever will you have about it, then do that there. We do appreciate that. It's available in all the places where you get podcasts, I think. Has anybody been like, oh yeah, I listen to podcasts through this weird thing and you're not there? Like, I don't feel like I've ever heard
no.
that.
No, there's like, there we go. 40 places for people to listen to it. It's all,
doing
all
something
the places.
Right. All the great places.
So that's it. I think you and I had a weird brain thing this week where we couldn't form thoughts and words or remember names or things, but that we got through it because that's what professionals do.
I want to say this. Really enjoyed reading my comics this week. I thought there was a very nice mix. I didn't have to think too hard about the pick, but I did have to think about it a little bit. It's good stuff, bad stuff, and I came here very excited to talk about them. I was
there
pumped.
You go. That's the name of the game. So let's do it again next week. Until then, I'm Connor.
I'm Josh. With just your name. And would I be sure that this is love beyond would all this be true if I didn't care for